البحر الأبيض المتوسط
مثل
الهجرة متنستفسي
بروسكاس أوروبا
أوروبا
الوصول الاستياء الحدود
كيندل
الخطر لجوء سياسة
مار ميديتراني
مار ميديتراني
ريفوجيادو Europa.
Refugiado.
Politik.
Arrivo.
Europa.
Sono. Migración.
Llegada.
Asilo. Pericolo.
Politik.
Asilo.
Frontera.
Politica.
Arrivé.
Peligro.
Frontière.
Asilo.
Danger.
Politica.
Refugié. Europe.
Herzlich willkommen bei unserem Podcast im Rahmen des Projekts zur Migration und zu den kommenden EU-Wahlen der Taz-Panther-Stiftung. Es bringt 6 Journalisten aus 6 verschiedenen Ländern zusammen, die sich rund um das Mittelmeer befinden. Alles Länder, in denen Migration entweder aus dem Land oder in das Land eine große Rolle spielt. Und ich freue mich, dass heute 3 Kollegen dabei sind. Ich bin Lisa Schneider, ich arbeite für das Auslandsressort der Taz und auch für die Taz-Panther-Stiftung. Und mit mir sind heute Alessia Manzo aus Italien, die unter anderem für La Repubblica schreibt, Stavros Malouchidis, der bei We Are Solomon in Griechenland arbeitet, einem Portal, das sich vor allem mit Migration beschäftigt, und Mirko Kalbert, Tunesien-Korrespondent der Taz. Wir haben uns entschieden, den Podcast auf Englisch zu machen, um eine möglichst authentische Diskussion zu ermöglichen. Es wird aber ein Transkript auf Deutsch geben, das Sie gerne lesen können, falls Ihnen das lieber ist. Es wird unten auf der Seite eingeblendet werden. So, I will switch to English now. And a warm welcome to my colleagues who are joining me on Zoom from their respective countries. It's a pleasure to have you here. So I want to begin with a quote from an article from Taz that we recently published, because it leads very much to the topic of today's discussion, which is, put very bluntly, does voting even make a difference? Or is migration policy basically out of the realm of what can be influenced by the choices of people? Because, as I will explain and my colleagues are going to explain in this podcast, it seems that migration policy in Europe is very much not influenced by how people vote or what is currently the mood of the population, but by basically driven by fear. So this is a strong thesis, I think, and we will discuss it now. But I'm going to start with the quote as mentioned. Italy's far-right head of government, Meloni, Giorgia Meloni, is in particular currently under pressure because she won the elections in the fall of 2022 with the promise to reduce the number of refugees arriving in Italy. Instead, more refugees have arrived in Italy since she took office than has been the case for several years. I think this is correct for all of Europe. Today we have people coming at a rate that is similar to 2015. So it's definitely after a period of lower numbers, it's rising again. So I want to ask you, Alessia, do you think that Meloni or her party, Fratelli d'Italia, will be punished in the EU elections for not coming true with this promise that they made in the last round of elections?
Yes, on the 8th and 9th June, Italy will be called to post to choose its representatives to be elected to the European Parliament. Assures that will take place in a particular delicate context, which sees Europe clashed between the conflicts, Russia, Ukraine, Middle East, and the advance of right-wing populism and neo-fascism. In the spirit that envelops extreme right-wing parties, far-right parties, there are also the group they make up the current Italian government, such as the President Meloni, Fratelli d'Italia, and Matteo Salvini of Lega Nord. Both Italian parties belong to the European groups of ECR, European Conservative and Reformist, and Identity and Democracy, respectively. The two European groups called for the defense of the nation and its roots while preparing the crusade against asylum seekers and the alleged Islamic terrorists arriving from the Mediterranean on all the Balkan route, and that have been ridden to hide the problems of the real countries, such as employment, low wages. I am Georgia. I am a mother. I am Italian. Italian spirits, stop invasion. Empty slogans. Over time, they have a whole new survey to food and a feeling of hostility against migrants in Italy and against those who arrive along the coasts or land routes that affects, such as on the Italian-Slovenian border, on the French-Italian border. Previous governments had already filed to protect the right to reception. With the modern government, we have also again seen the rights of those knock on the Europe doors, the demand a bit of future.
I just want to add something to, or I just want to, take the agreement you just mentioned to pass the question on to Stavros, because, or actually to Mirko first, because it's not just Italy that makes these kind of deals that basically are intended to keep migrants out. The EU has made a number of such deals, and one of the most recent ones was the deal with Tunisia. Mirko, can you tell us a little bit, how this deal was received in Tunisia? And B, because I know that you are very much connected with migrants who are looking to leave Tunisia on the way to Europe, how this agreement basically has been received in their communities specifically.
So I think Tunisia is a very interesting melting pot, let's say, for these problems that Europe tries to hand over to other countries, because since 2014, people from West Africa, migrants, but also students can come to Tunisia without a visa. So you have as well a lot of people who have fled Libya, have fled the detention centers and the behavior by Libyan militias, coming for a safe haven that Tunisia, they thought, could be. And for a long time, it worked quite well. I think until beginning of last year, we had a kind of solution in Tunisia that means people had informal jobs, the migrants and the refugees in the service industry in Tunisia. And it was a kind of balance, I would say, not a solution because there's no asylum law, but there was a kind of equilibrium between the local population, and you know that Tunisians are going in massive numbers to Europe too, and this migrant community, until the Italian Minister of Interior came and later Prime Minister Meloni, and at the end said, well, we are both victims of this migration stream. We are both countries that are not the end destination like Germany, but we should do something against it, and we should try to make the people move. So Kais Saied, in his speech in January last year, in February last year, he kind of called migration a kind of conspiracy against Arab and Islamic culture in North Africa. And what the result was that the anger that many Tunisians had about their own social situation, about their own failure, about the failure of democracy, and we're talking about elections today as well, the failure that to elect political parties for 10 years since the Arab Spring, since 2011, did not improve their life, their economic life at all. Suddenly there was a scapegoat, and I think it is this very miserable, let's say, European Tunisian autocratic cooperation, let's say, that led to violence against migrants. Lisa, you asking about what's the result or what's the response in the migrant communities, where I'm quite frequently in Sfax and other coastal cities here in Tunisia. They say, well, obviously, nobody wants us here in Tunisia, so let us go. And they don't understand why Europe wants to keep them here in Tunisia and wants and let the Tunisian authorities behave quite violently against the community and not letting them go by boat, because they say they don't want to stay in North Africa, they don't want to stay in Libya and Egypt. Local population doesn't want these communities here. And they share the same wish to go northbound. So I think this is a kind of really, not everybody's aware that this is not a solution.
I actually want to ask you, do you think that in general, in Tunisia, these deals have any impact? Or is it more a case of the pressure in Tunisia and in the countries where migrants come to Tunisia from is so bad or so much that people don't actually feel the need to adhere to this deal because the pressure is just too high?
Actually, I have met a lot of people who are deeply traumatized, who lost friends on the sea. I have met not only one, two, but dozens of people who were witnessing how somebody died in the desert or on the sea. And for them, you know, even you hear from those people, let me try it again. Why do the Tunisian authorities or the Libyan authorities not let me risk my life again? I know it sounds absurd from a European point of view, but I hear the same answers over and over again from somebody in Lagos. I can name any other country, not only countries that are in war like Sudan, but many others. And majority, I have nothing to lose. I can earn maximum $50 a month in an informal job in my home country. I have nothing that is waiting for me there. And yeah, for them, all these deals, and also the very brutal way that the authorities or militias in Libya and Tunisia are going against them, or in Morocco as well, it doesn't mean anything for them because they know only one direction. This is northbound. They will try and they will try and they'll try again. So what is interesting, I think, is that people who got a job, and I met a lot of those people as well in Libya, who got a kind of safe environment in Sfax, but also in Tripoli in Libya, they were starting to think to stay and not to risk in their lives, also because they had kids with them or their family. So what this deal is not bringing, the Italian-Tunisian deal or the European-Tunisian deal, is any safety for people there for one very clear reason. It should be a deterrence factor, you know.
Yes.
I heard it from some members of parliament. As the situation has to look like that, so those people here in Tunisia now, they send a message back to West Africa, don't come, don't dare it. But this will not happen. So I think what this cooperation lacks is the awareness that treating people inhuman doesn't mean that they will not continue, you know, to come and to work. No, they are ready to sacrifice their life, you know, for this trip.
I want to add something to that, actually another quote from another article in Taz, because it's not just the danger of losing your life on the Mediterranean, but also what awaits you when you come, because the conditions, especially in Greece in 2015 or on the Eastern European borders, even today, are actually quite horrible. And it's not just that, and this is the quote. In Greece, for example, a new law has regulated the criminal offense of aiding and abetting illegal entry since 2020. Since then, practically any form of assistance, medical care, transportation, sea rescue within territorial waters, or the distribution of food can be prosecuted if the person has not been officially registered, if they have just arrived. So assistance is theoretically permitted, but helpers must first coordinate with the authorities that can refuse assistance. So this basically means that in Greece, even helping people arriving, helping people in distress can be illegal. So I want to ask you, Stavros, because Greece does not have a far-right government. It's not the Fratelli di Greece, basically, that are ruling the country, but a conservative government. Where do you think this tendency in Greece to be even more harsh towards migrants than the Italian government today comes from?
I would say that the current Greek government has fallen victim to the rhetoric that it used before coming into power. So before 2019, when it came into power, the current government of New Democracy employed the rhetoric that was very much against people on the move, against refugees, and that very much criminalized people on the move. So when it came to power, its voters who had built trust on this kind of rhetoric, they possibly expected that from the government. And the government also, I think, realized that this kind of rhetoric, it really helps the government become more solid. The law you mentioned is in place, but reality is that before that, there were also cases of criminalization of people who were aiding refugees arriving in the country. In the previous years, as you mentioned, like in 2015, there were big numbers, arrival of people. In 2015, there were over 1 million people that arrived and passed through Greece, mostly to continue, of course, to Central and Northern Europe. And one thing that relates to what you mentioned is that, for example, we can see that now, for the past 3 years maybe, there are no search and rescue collectives, NGOs, that help, for example, on the islands close to Turkey with boats that are coming and there might be a shipwreck. There used to be different NGOs and grassroots organizations who helped, but this is not the case anymore. So assistance to refugees when they are arriving to the country is criminalized. We have had cases of NGOs which had to go through smuggling charges. And in the end, in all the cases, the people have been found innocent. But this doesn't mean that, you know, to get there, you will not have to spend 4 or 5 years of being prosecuted and having to face all these legal threats. So this has made also collectives, people who are showing solidarity to the people on the move and NGOs, be more hesitant into the extent and the levels of help they can provide to people on the move.
I want to get back to something you said in the very beginning, that the government is driven by the promises they made during the election process. Taz is a left-wing newspaper, and the Taz Panther Foundation is, of course, not a newspaper, but I think there's a general tendency of people that are listening to this podcast or that are reading Taz to be more left-wing in general. So I think from our perspective, it is often seen that people just don't know, basically, migrants, or they don't have any idea of what the situation is like, and this is why they, you know, decide to vote for something like Nea Democratica or for Fratelli d'Italia, because they don't have enough contact, basically, with people to understand their needs and desires and why they are coming to Europe. Do you think, especially for those that live on Greek islands and have contacts with migrants every day, do you think this is true or it's actually the opposite?
I agree totally with your view on this. I mean, there is a very, very big level of disinformation when it comes to, you know, people on the move arriving in Greece. This hasn't changed at all. I remember it since, you know, 10 years ago, it was the same, and today it's still the same. For example, there's very broadly the idea that people on the move, like asylum seekers in Greece, that they get very, very big financial benefits. This is the idea, you know, like the majority of society has. While in practice, you know, like asylum seekers, individuals, they get like 75 euros per month, you know, which I think in a European country, we would never call that like substantial financial incentive or something. There is very, very big disinformation, like when it comes to what third country nationals are entitled to, why they're coming here, to the numbers. It's always presented as if, you know, it's so many people arriving that Greece can't do it, while the numbers are quite small. Like this year, it's like 11,000 people have arrived in Greece. In the summer, we have tens of millions and of tourists, and I don't see any issue there. There's a lack of decent and objective information. And one thing that has really not made things easier over the past years is that the government has been creating these closed centers where people on the move live. These are on the islands. These are funded by the EU with you know, millions and millions of euros. And this you know, isolation of people on the move from the local society, I think this doesn't make things better, because it doesn't give the chance to interact. It doesn't give the chance for people to actually see how things are. And this is how we reach to these alarming perceptions. If you examine one by one most of the perceptions of that people have for people on the move, you will realize that, you know, they are not as described. You know, as long as I have been reporting on this issue, this has always been the case.
Yes, I think this is a parallel that is also true in Tunisia, as well as Italy, as well as probably Germany, that there is a lot of misinformation and, you know, opinions based on a very selective information that does not correspond to the reality itself, perhaps. If you keep that in mind, I think the situation with the upcoming elections is even more either interesting or dreadful, however you want to view it, because elections or the migration will play a huge role in the elections, but there is a huge level of disinformation, of misinformation, and I think in general you can even say that people are very tired of news with two big ongoing wars, a lot of disinformation, a lot of, you know, selection process you have to make in order to find news that even makes sense in a way. So how do you think, and this is a question for all of you, how do you think this can be countered before the elections? How do you think a more, let's say, truthful approach to migration can be achieved?
Well, maybe I can start with a view from Tunis, where you have this, well, both communities, the hosting community who wants a better life in Europe and the migrant and refugee community that is either like the Sudanese that have saved their lives because it's a huge war with 7 million refugees, or they want just to earn money and to make a normal living. And both communities understand quite well that Europe wants to keep this topic out of the news, let's say, and want to keep them away until June, until summer, because of the elections. I heard it even from a lot of migrants. By the way, it's really interesting to see that even when you're in the olive fields, in these kind of informal refugee camps, people you talk to, they have quite good understanding about politics in Europe. They're listening to these things. They're not unaware that they're not welcomed. What works quite well in that situation you just described, Lisa, where everybody can't cope with another problem, it seems quite easy for politicians to keep this thing out of the public. And literally, that's what happened in Tunisia. And I think in Greece, on the Greek islands with the closed camps, here in Tunisia, it is the olive fields were near the city of Sfax, where people are out of public opinion. Local journalists are not allowed to go there. Even members of European parliaments are not allowed to come. And what helps, I think, is to start an open discussion. I think there was already a way how to deal with it. Certainly, this was without climate change. This was before the European Union was closing off the outside world. But there was a kind of seasonal migration from all these countries for work. For example, Tunisians went for harvesting season or building season to Sicily, to Italy, made some money, went back. They didn't need a visa. And people from sub-Saharan Africa came for until the Arab Spring to Libya and worked in Tunisian hotels to make some money and went back and invested that money in their home country. I think what really is not helping is that it is so difficult for Tunisians, North Africans, to work in Europe, you know, and they themselves are so much more blocked from the world they see on their smartphones and on YouTube and on social media than ever before. I think the only good thing what Meloni's visit to Tunisia brought, that or the first good step maybe, is to allow more young Tunisians to go to Europe and to reconnect and to tell their stories. And maybe the second step would be to try to get people from West Africa looking for a good job, to allow them to go to, in a legal way, to Europe. That doesn't mean it has to be millions all of a sudden, how the right-wing political scene would now warn, but to find formal ways of migration, I think, is the only way forward. Because what now everybody in North Africa witnesses, that even after this brutal, brutal way authorities in Libya and Tunisia are going against migration, the numbers are not lower. It will not work. There are more migrants coming through the Algerian and the Libyan borders to Sfax, to Tunisia, than last year, despite people being deported to the desert. So Europe and Tunisia, in this case, have to find new ways to legalize migration and to talk about it in a different way, to personalize it.
We have a lot of problem with the information in Italy, because the government called the refugees like to invasion. The government has made the migrants part of the economic crisis, but this is not the case. Well, there is a lot of misinformation, and in invasion is being constructed that does not exist. If we look at the numbers, Meloni says that some countries, such as Tunisia, are safe. One only has to listen to the stories of the Jews, trying to understand that this is not the case. The propaganda newspapers tell of 50 young people arriving illegally with smartphones. Yet this is not the case. It's a propaganda from the government of Meloni.
Do you think, Stavros, this is also true in the situation of Greece? Because if you look at the origin countries of migrants coming to Greece, there's a lot more prevalence of countries like Syria or Afghanistan, where there's still not an active war, maybe, but a simmering conflict and a generally more, I say, volatile situation.
Yes, this is the case in Greece. And I mean, also, if you take into perspective all the past years, the top nationalities of people arriving in Greece, it's people who are, when they do file an asylum claim, in very, very big numbers, they will be recognized as refugees. They will be recognized as in need of international protection. So in very big parts, it's, as you said, from Syria and Afghanistan. There are, of course, numbers of people from Palestine. These were also, you know, before the latest years. And then you have, for example, also people like from Eritrea, for example, but in general, or Somalia. Like the majority, I would say, of people who arrive in Greece, I think it's over 65-70%. It is people, once their asylum claim is processed after a long waiting period, they will be recognized as refugees.
So to wrap up our discussions, there's basically two factors, one in a journalistic sense and one in a political sense, that might help to unravel a bit this very difficult topic of migration. So the first one is for journalists to go where you're not supposed to go, basically to Sfax or to these detention centers in Greece, if it's possible, you know, to keep looking at what the government does not like you to see and to report about it, especially. before the election. So this technique of keeping the topic out of the pre-election coverage will not succeed. And the second one is that perhaps finding legal ways, although this is not for journalists an important point, but for politicians, finding legal ways for people to earn a living in Europe without having to go through the process of asylum, without having to go through everything that is connected with that. Thank you very much to my colleagues Stavros, Alessia and Mirko for sharing their perspectives and for joining me this evening on this discussion. I think it was very insightful, I hope also for our listeners, and thank you very much for being here. Wir danken der Taz Panther Stiftung, die dieses Projekt ermöglicht hat, und allen Spendern, die sich daran beteiligt haben, die das möglich machen. Dieser Podcast ist erst der Auftakt zu einer Serie. Es geht weiter. Wir wollen vor den EU-Wahlen ganz genau hinschauen zum Thema Migration und wollen dazu Austausch unter europäischen Journalisten und Journalisten aus dem Mittelmeerraum ermöglichen. Und in diesem Sinne freuen wir uns über weitere Spenden auf taz.de/spenden. Herzlichen Dank.
Europa.
Refugiado.
Politik.
Arrivo.
Europa.
Sono. Migration.
Chiara.
Asilo. Pericolo. Politik.
Asilo.
Frontera. Politica.
Arrivé.
Peligro.
Frontière.
Asilo.
Danger.
Politica.
Réfugié. Europe.